This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Steve Brooks. I'm talking today with Klaus Jepsen, Deputy CTO at Unit 4, about microservices architecture. Gartner defines a microservice as a tightly scoped, strongly encapsulated, loosely coupled, independently deployable, and independently scalable application component. What is a microservices architecture, Klaus?
That's a very good question. A microservice in itself is, as per the definition, a defined set of functionality doing one specific thing. That's how I think about it. I don't think so much about a microservice in terms of code size or anything like that. More in terms of, I have a specific task, I have specific functionality I want done, and it makes sense to group that into one service, where you previously could say you would have a module inside a larger code stream. You now pull that module out and you put it into its own service, and it have everything it needs to work, which means it becomes an independent application that can run independently. On terms of scaling, so now we're sort of going into something else in the architecture. If it needs to be super scalable, it also means that you need to make sure it's stateless, you need to make sure it, if you're serving many customers, it's multi-tenant and so forth. All these properties need to be in place as well. But it is, in my view, a well-defined set of functionality that logically belongs together and needs to be updated on its own without necessarily impacting other parts of the system.
Is it just functionality? What about the data underpinning it, though?
And a microservice needs to own its destiny. So it needs to own all aspects of what it needs. It needs to own the business logic, of course, but it also needs to have the data it needs to actually honor and do the business logic. And it should also contain the user interaction piece, the presentation layer, and the code involved in interacting with the end users. When you have microservices in a grander scale in an enterprise architecture, you need to be able to get the data into a separate data store. And it's really key, because if you don't do that, you lose some of the flexibility you get with microservices. The great thing about microservices is you can essentially have chunks of code that sort of have its own development life cycle, and you can update it independently. You control your destiny. But if you then at the end, and there's a lot of people who have done that, then they build these microservices. But when they get to the data layer, they still want to force it into the good old SQL database. But then you get this new contention point, because if you need to do something that requires you to update your database schema, make changes, or enrich the data, you can't really do that because you risk hurting everybody in the ecosystem. That was one of the challenges you have in monolithic applications if you want to make changes to the database. Whereas if the microservice is loosely coupled with the different sources of data, you simply just have to make sure that you have the data sets you need in that specific microservice to do the business logical functionality it needs to do.
That sounds simple, but surely two different microservices will want to own the same piece of data. Just in terms of, say, a customer record, a name, will be contained within different elements of data. It might contain with the sales data, it might contain the accounting data. Who owns it? How do you make sure that it's updated correctly and the length the same? From what you said, you have two different versions of that data. So how does that work?
How does that work? So essentially, you need to identify the system of record for these master data elements. Now we're talking about the customer. The customer typically resides in the CRM piece. Let's take the customer. The way that we have done it and should be done, for an example, if you update any master data in the P or any of the other systems that's actually the system of record, it will send out an event. So it's all event-based and event-driven. In the event, tell what happened. In this particular case, we update the customer name. As part of that event, it will also contain, we use JSON and we refer to these artifacts as enterprise documents. It will then put into the messaging system the event, what happened, and the payload, essentially a JSON representation of the customer record in the CRM system. The other microservices then, they will then pick that up and they see an update, and then they can update their copy of that, or the attributes they store. They may only store a subset, like the business key for the customer and the customer name. But these cannot change the name of the customer. They can only use it for displaying, for example, on an order, if you have to approve supply invoices and so forth.
Holger Müller, Vice President Principal Analyst at Constellation, said Unit 4 is one of the most modern architectures of any ERP. And he was talking about your microservices architecture there. You didn't always have a modern architecture here, though. How did that come about?
The whole journey for us from a predominantly monolithic application started about 5 years ago, where we started looking at, we wanted to have a true multi-tenant cloud-native ERP solution. And in order to get to that, we had to build the underlying platform, which later we named the People Platform. So the first steps was to take those and build the messaging capabilities, security, authorization, and all these good central pieces we constructed first. And when we had that infrastructure in place, we pushed forward and started digging into the application itself and breaking it apart and reassembling it essentially. Nobody told us that from the architect perspective was going to build a microservice architecture. We were told to build what was the best thing to operate in the cloud. And this turned out to be an architecture that consists of loosely coupled event driven, number of services that they could be microservices. There's some larger chunk we refer to as macroservices. And then, of course, we also use Azure serverless computing for specific tasks as well. The tasks were not to build a microservice architecture, but to build the most efficient cloud-native ERP solution.
You referred to macroservices there. So is microservices a misnomer for the architecture? Should be micro and microservices architecture.
How big is micro compared to macro? And what is nano? I don't know. It depends. But yes, I would say that it's a combination of a number of differentiated services in size. Some of these is definitely microservices, even to the purest definition, and some of them are not per the pure definition. They're more microservices, yeah.
When you break these things up, you obviously decided on the size of them. How do you make that kind of decision? In the sense that, is it based on, well, actually, I only want one team of developers working on a specific area, and therefore, and then a team of developers shouldn't be more than 10 or 12 people, and therefore they can cope with that amount of workload? How do you actually make the decision?
In many things in life, there is not like a fixed recipe for how it works. And even if you read the recipe, the food never looks as good as in the picture in the cookbook. So you have to go after what you think makes sense. And also, when we build new, we look at what is this service is supposed to do. And we don't look so much about the number of lines of code. But the microservices, and I would call them true microservices, we have as part of the People Platform, maintained by one development team. Which is then you have a tester, you have an architect, a business analyst, and you have 3 to 4 developers. So that sort of, they can maintain one of these artifacts or microservice. When we look at the ERP solution, the way we broke that up and still working on breaking it up is that we are taking some more domain-specific approach to it. So we are saying we have a projects part, the projects functionality. And then we split that out and put that into specific service. And then we solve the integration points with the rest of the application. The next refinement could then go be in a look, is there bits and pieces of that we can break out even granular and make even smaller services. And then depending on the size of these, we allocate the number of people required to maintain it. But in general, if you have more than 2 teams working on the same code base, it gets messy regardless of what you're doing.
Why? What are the advantages?
The advantages is, here I'm supposed to say agility, because everybody talks about that. But I think flexibility for me is the most important thing. It gives you enormous amount of flexibility in making changes to different aspects of the system without necessarily have to go through this long process of making sure that you get all the code into the same, you get everything compiled, you get it up and running, and you have to run through enormous amount of testing. Because when everything is tightly knit and you have in-memory function calls rather than external API calls, the risk for cascading and regression is way bigger, essentially. We have to remember a fairly substantial ERP solution. We are talking 11, 12 million lines of code. It's a significant piece of software. So the advantage is the flexibility it gives you in terms of pushing out new feature functions independently of what is needed everywhere else in the system. And it also gives you the flexibility to some extent to have different life cycles. For example, we have some microservices that gets updated every Friday. We have some we update every month, and we have some we update quarterly, depending on what's exactly going on inside them and how complicated we need to do as. There's another advantage to it, is the scalability. So for example, if you have a monolithic application, let's say you have a multi-tenant monolithic application, that one has a certain size. It takes up memory, it takes up disk space, takes up a lot of good stuff. If you have to scale it, then you have to scale these big chunks. Whereas if you have smaller elements, these can scale independently. They scale differently depending on what the usage is. You get a better usage of your resources, essentially, by doing it this way. Now we are using Azure. You get a way bigger toolbox in terms of deploying into different technologies on Azure. Whereas if you have a really big service, it tends to be on either on instances or something like that, which is more expensive to run on, even though it can scale, it's still an instance space. Whereas if you're doing it new microservices, you can use all the PaaS services, which gives you a high degree of flexibility and also makes it cheaper because you get a better utilization.
You're saying effectively, I think, is that you may have a microservice that's processor intensive and you may have a separate microservice that's memory intensive. You can scale appropriately for each microservices, whereas in a monolithic architecture, you have to scale both at the same time, regardless if only one needs to scale.
The first thing is to get people to understand the concept of building software this way over monolith. Most people who write software still think very monolithic about it. So that's one thing. It requires more governance to make sure that, yeah, because one of the great things about microservices people say is they can use whatever technology they want. And we talked a little about that before we started the podcast. And essentially, that's not going to fly. So you need to make sure that you have some architectural governance. You also have to pay way more attention to the underlying infrastructure you run on in terms of costs. So an architect today, previously we were mostly concerned about how do we build the best software-based maintainable software. If it consumed tons of resources on the customer side, that was really not our problem. But now we own the TCO. We own the operational cost. So we also have to think about, in the design, how do we get the best services? When you build a monolith, you just go and you build it, and then you give it to somebody and run it. But if you build a microservice that's really based on using PaaS, you have to do more thinking about these elements that you previously didn't really think about.
And what are the disadvantages?
Embedded programming on a Z80.
Sounds like a bit of a blast in the past where you had limited memory and limited storage and you actually have to go back and program it very, very tightly somehow. You said you have to get developers to think about how they develop in a microservices way rather than a monolithic way. Could you just dig into that a little bit more, what you meant?
Maybe it's not so much about the microservice. When you build microservice that you want to run in a cloud, as an enterprise vendor as we are, you also need to make sure it's multi-tenant and you also have to think about scalability and stuff like that, which you typically don't really think about when you're writing a monolith. And not in terms of macro scalability. You may think about multi-threading and stuff inside the monolith code, but whereas you go to a microservice that's super scalable, you need to take into consideration that first of all, you can have many users coming in from different tenants, different customers. You need to make sure that you cannot guarantee there's no state between the calls because you can risk that the next call goes somewhere else. You could, of course, also have the same situations in a monolith. And then second, when you build services that run something like cloud, then you have to be very aware about failure, fault tolerance. And you need to consider that at any given time, there can be a cyber attack on these environments as well, because your code won't get locked down as you typically see with monolithic structures. You have to pay attention way more to around on the build and deployment piece, on how you sort of structure that in terms of the complete lifecycle of the microservice.
You mentioned APIs earlier. There's a lot of talk around applications being open API architectures. Is that microservices architecture or is it different?
Not necessarily. An API is a gateway into some functionality. You can't really see what sits behind it. You could say that the microservice architecture is the evolution of service-oriented architecture, but service-oriented architecture was essentially about putting APIs on an existing code base. So we started this whole API economy, started coming from that. No, it's not the same. It doesn't have to be the same. It's not the same, no.
If you had a vendor saying, oh, we've got a microservices architecture, what's the question you should ask them just to ensure it's not just an open API architecture?
Well, I would use some of the questions we talked about. I would say, okay, that's interesting. How did you break it down? For example, if I want to use, let's say, your finance module, is that a separate piece? Is it all going into the same application? A better question could be if they start down that path thing, have you said, hey, by the way, I like this functionality I saw in projects. I want that, but I would like to keep the rest of this. If they can honor that, then there is a good chance that they actually have a microservice architecture sitting beneath, or a separation in some sort of chunks that allows them to update specific pieces of the application.
One of the promises of microservices architecture, which I've read about, is around how you can choose any software tools or languages. In other words, you can choose the best tool and language for each of the microservices you're developing. Is there a danger in that, or is that an advantage, or can it be a disadvantage if you take it too far?
If you as a company like us have a significant part of development going on, if we had everything done in different stacks, it wouldn't be really efficient and cost efficient. We have to standardize on some things. And we also have to make sure that in many cases, people need to move between projects. So having something done in Lisp and something in C# and Ruby and Perl just doesn't make sense. And also you have to be very mindful about, as I said earlier, the past services you're using. So you have to look at the different, what a microservice is doing. Is it heavy on CPU? Is it heavy on I/O? Is it heavy? What is it heavy on? Based on what it's heavy on, then you should have a governance around, okay, so for this type of service, I will use a document store. I would use a SQL store for storage. Because if you all of a sudden just throw something else in there, like a MongoDB, then all of a sudden from an operational perspective, you have another component you need to maintain. I think if you do that, let's say you had all microservices had their own technology, you would end up in a maintenance nightmare and execution nightmare running it. I don't think it's going to work. But the advantage of it is that if you then go and acquire another company, then it's less of a concern if it's done in a different technology, because then you could slowly move it if you want to. But you could still get the service to collaborate on your underlying native protocol without having to do a lot of rewriting and retrofitting in the code base.
From Unit 4's perspective, do you just write in one type of language, or are there languages for different types of service?
Our main development language is .NET based, so we use C# and .NET as a platform, and that's why we're on Azure. We have a slightly smaller population of Java and a really small Ruby code base, but we prefer .NET.
We talked about data and we've talked about different systems of record, but there is also a trend to going towards a data warehouse and business analytics and analytics on top. And actually, don't you want a single element of data for that as well? You want to be able to just look at one data store to pull out the insights from that.
That's what typically refers to as a data lake. Whenever there is a change to any data or created any data, the system sends out the data as JSON. And then you can store that data in the data lake, and it just sits there. On top of that is where you should run your analytics. And we also have a data lake. We just haven't released it yet, but we have a data lake as well where we capture all the information coming in, and that's on top of that you do it. Because what you end up in a microservice, you have a complete microservice ecosystem, is that you have way too many places to go to get the data. So it needs to come into one place, and that would be the data lake.
You obviously came in and helped this transition process to the new architecture. What were the challenges you faced?
The first challenge was to get people on my own team to understand what I was trying to do. Because 5 years ago, the whole cloud notion, building cloud solution, even though it's only 5 years ago, was for many fairly new. So that was an interesting first year to get people up to speed inside my own team on what this meant when we built the platform services. It's also interesting to try to explain the benefits to the business of this. Is this really necessary or nice to have? We make our decision on what we want to invest in based on business cases. Where is, does it make sense or doesn't it make sense? There's been some interesting discussions about this, whether we could just continue with the existing architecture or we really had to go to the new architecture. Since we now have it, that solved that discussion as well.
So what were the business benefits? What was the convincing argument?
Well, the convincing argument was that by doing so, we actually get one version, we get better operations, because like everybody else, if you take our old architecture, that's hosting. There's no encapsulation in the data, so you need to essentially end up running a hosting shop rather than a cloud. So all that goes away, so you can have far less people running the application than you had before. It's fast. For example, if you want to push out new functionality, if you're having a discussion with a big customer, then you need something, you could push it out faster. And we ended up having a true multi-tenant application. We don't yell that all the time because we don't have that.
One of the things you talked about before we started this podcast was how you couldn't take your solution now to an on-premise installation. Why? Technically, why can't you put it onto an on-premise?
The current solution is using specific Azure services that are simply not available. An Azure stack is not one-to-one.
Was that a conscious decision?
Yes.
Was that a tough argument to have? Did they just find out afterwards?
I don't think we asked anyone. We just did it. We had a discussion when we started. We went to Microsoft and made this agreement on using Azure. And then, of course, we said from architect engineering, we said, listen, are we all in on this? Because if you're all in, that will allow us to develop faster, but higher degree of tie-in with the Azure platform, at least enough that we cannot go on-premise, because we would have specific service you would like to use that's not available on-premise. We can, of course, with sufficient investment, move to a different cloud that offers those equivalent services, but not on-premise. This is a cloud solution, and it was never designed and intended to go on-premise.
In your public sector side, Are they using the microservices architecture? People like Malta and Cyprus? Is that also hosted in the cloud? Because it's often quite difficult to get public sector organizations, especially national governments, to go on to a cloud solution, especially one that's not in their own country.
Yeah, but they're using the Business World 7 code stream.
So historic, monolithic code stream.
What we did was that the underlying event-driven mechanisms and APIs to connect to, for example, the people platform services like messaging, Wonder, the extensibility through the kits, extension kit and integration kit, we put that into Business World from version 6.4. It's only available for users with 7, so it's been there. That means that any customer on version 7 can use those services. It's just that they cannot install it on-premise. So they can still get Wonder, they can still create integrations and extensions using the cloud-based services, but the core ERP, the core good old Business World in its monolithic architecture, sits on-premise. If you look at our code stream, it's called the M8, that's the cloud one.
So the cloud one's 8, so you couldn't run 8 on-premise?
Well, they can do that if they can move to the cloud.
Does that mean that Malta and Cyprus will never upgrade their ERP?
Yeah, otherwise they will stay on the on-premise version.
Klaus, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.